Chapter 6 1947 Eleanor followed Detective Chief Inspector Stephen Warren until he reached Whitehall Place. She knew her unofficial surveillance came with risk in this area. There were few pedestrians, no shop doorways to step into, and at that moment only a smattering of vehicular traffic. At one point, when Warren turned around, he might have noticed Eleanor had his attention not been on the ankles of a young woman emerging from one of the government offices along the street. Warren continued walking at a fair clip and did not slow as he approached a black motor car. The door swung open, and without losing momentum, he climbed in. The vehicle pulled out before even a second had elapsed, after the passenger door closed. Fortunately, the motor car proceeded away from Eleanor, not toward her. She slowed her pace, looked both ways, and crossed the road. She hoped she appeared suitably nondescript, another civil servant walking between offices, just in case the driver had glanced in his rearview mirror and seen her. Clouds moved in the sky above at an opportune moment, allowing a beam of sunlight to catch the back window, revealing the silhouetted figure Warren had joined. Was Warren keeping to a previously arranged meeting with no link to Eleanor's appearance in London? Or was there a direct relationship? She reminded herself that there were a good number of open cases to keep Warren and his men in the flying squad busy for a very long time, and work had become Warren's first love, his first commitment. She was sure that if Steve Warren prayed at all, it would be about his work. But all the same, Eleanor would have parted with good money to know who he was joining in the motor car. The chauffeured vehicle suggested official government business, and though communication with those in the higher echelons of the country's security was part of Warren's remit, Eleanor knew her curiosity regarding the identity of the other passenger would nag like a stone in her shoe until she had put a name to him. When the car turned left into Whitehall, she doubled back toward Scotland Yard. Deep in thought, she approached the embankment and stopped to watch the capital's famous river wind its way toward the sea. The tide was out, providing opportunity for the mudlarks, Londoners who picked over the Thames mud, to appear. Using their fingers or sticks, they came in search of long-lost treasures or anything washed up by the current that could be sold or bartered. She understood that clay pipes from the Middle Ages were still to be found, though since the Blitz, part of a downed Spitfire or lumps of shrapnel were not unusual, and scrap metal could always find a buyer. But it was the promise of an ancient gold coin or two that brought in the scavengers at low tide every day. The Thames was the part of London Eleanor felt most drawn to. It was always there, and more often than not it had a way of reflecting her moods. It could seem at rest, moving at a slower pace during times when she felt the need to withdraw, to go into herself. Then it would turn, swollen by grey storms and full tide, a mirror for her frustration or anger. And it would change again, as if meandering with intent to get on with doing the job demanded of it, which, for the water, was the safe passage of people and goods from far and wide. That's what the local people called it, the water. I'm going over the water. He works on the water. The water will flood again, just you wait. The Luftwaffe had used the moon's reflection on that precious water, following the glorious silver ribbon to come in time and again to inflict bombing after bombing on warehouses, businesses and houses, back-to-back homes where ordinary working people lived ordinary lives. They were a people who sought refuge as London's lifeblood spilled into the ancient river on the nights they dreaded, a bomber's moon illuminating the way for terror. And on one December night, Hermann Göring planned a raid with meticulous detail to coincide with low tide, so as fast as the London fire crews fed hoses into the Thames, expecting to draw water to fight the firestorm raising the city, so those hoses were choked with silt and debris. London's burning, London's burning. Fetch the engines. Fire, 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 fire. Pour on water, pour on water. A children's rhyme coming true again, centuries after that first great fire. True, Eleanor had only a few years of knowing London before it was changed forever by war, but this waterway drew her in. It was hard for her to imagine that it began as springs arising from an aquifer at Thames Head in the Cotswolds. And it was only when the German George I, the first Hanoverian monarch in Britain, acceded to the throne and could not pronounce TH, that the name of the river might as well have been spelled Thames. She remembered asking about it when she visited London as a child, and her English grandmother informed her, "What the king says is what is right, and he said Thames." Now, standing alongside the river, she knew that within a few miles the very water that was the focus of her attention would join the North Sea, its burgeoning swell rising to be battered by heaving waves rolling in at Gravesend. Gravesend. The end of Graves. Names of towns along the way marked the river's passage, a waterway used by incomers, welcome and unwelcome since early times, buoying them along to their destination. Londinium, London, 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 home. Eleanor stood on the embankment and focused on the entrance to Scotland Yard, waiting. She did not need to linger long before the man she wanted to speak to emerged. She watched him turn to his left. He looked both ways, crossed the road, and stepped onto the pavement only a few yards from where she was standing. Sometimes serendipity worked in her favour. "Oh, Charlie," she waved to him as he turned. "Mind if I join you? I'm walking that way." Detective Sergeant Charles Kettle's eyes widened for a second. He had been reaching for a packet of cigarettes when she called out, and now returned them to the inside pocket of his tweed jacket. Eleanor noticed two things as he drew back the buttonholed side of the jacket, a grey shirt that should have been white and was therefore in need of a wash, starch and hot iron, and the weapon he wore to the left against his ribcage. It was a Webley revolver, an armed forces standard issue along with the Enfield No. 2. It was the sidearm of choice, though she knew the Smith & Wesson was also being put to good use on both sides of the law. It paid to know the weapon remade and used by friend and foe alike. "You don't have to put away your cigarettes on my account, Charlie," said Eleanor, approaching the policeman. "It was so stuffy in DCI Warren's office, I thought I would go for a walk along the embankment." Charlie reached for his packet of cigarettes again and pushed up one to offer Eleanor, who shook her head. "Had to give them up so I could breathe, Charlie. I smoked a few too many during the war." He nodded. "I should probably do the same." He coughed as he lit the cigarette and drew on it before taking it from his mouth, blowing smoke to the side and studying the glowing end of the cigarette for a second. "I'm going to the tube, you?" They fell into step, shafts of sunlight once more breaking through the clouds. "Bit of shopping," said Eleanor. "Anyway, I'll walk with you toward the tube. Not often we get some clear air here, is it?"
"Not often."
Eleanor allowed a step or two in silence before speaking again. "You've got your work cut out for you, haven't you, Charlie? These criminals are like jelly, tricky to round up, and I bet they slip through your fingers as often as not."
"I'll say."
He drew on his cigarette again, closing one eye as a breeze blew smoke into his face.
"You know what the trouble is? Well, there's a good few things causing trouble, but half the trouble is the people who live on the streets around where these villains operate."
"The people? You mean locals not involved in crime?" Charlie Kettle laughed.
"Oh, Miss White, you don't know the streets, do you? Everyone's involved in crime. For a start, them same locals will tell you that it's the likes of the Mackies who keep the streets clean. Any filth comes in, and by filth, you know what I mean, your pimps, your prostitutes, and your spibs from outside, well, the Mackey family gets rid of them."
He held out two fingers, the cigarette clutched between them as he pointed to the river.
"And after someone in the Mackey's employ has dealt with a problem they don't want, You'll see the problem floating along, never to be seen walking the streets again. When the river police haul out the body, there's usually only half left, or they don't float in the first place because they're encased in concrete. We know for a fact that there's a number of small-time bad seeds holding up Rotherhithe docks, even as you and I stand here.
A charming thought, said Eleanor. Kettle gave a half laugh.
Ask anyone who lives within a mile of Mickleham Street what they think of Francis Ghost Boys, and you'll hear them say, he loved his old mum, though, and they keep the streets clean round here. Then they'll say, which is more than can be said for the police. Coppers can't even keep their shoes clean.
And they would be right. We can't be everywhere. And if we're everywhere, then we're nowhere when there's trouble, so we have to pick our battles.
Sometimes I wonder if it's all worth it, but the pay packet keeps a roof over my family's head. My army pension doesn't give me a pot to...
Yes, I see, said Eleanor, not waiting for him to finish the phrase.
And of course the bad boys look after people, continued the detective. The housewives think they're getting something free when they're offered a pound or two of sugar on the side, so they pay up and say, thank you very much, nice of you to think of us. But the Mackies are offering sugar because they're making a tidy profit from a job over at the sugar factory that the company didn't report. And why don't they report it? Because they don't want trouble either. They say south of the river is London's breadbasket for all the food factories over there, but it's nice pickings for the Mackies.
Kettle drew on his cigarette again.
And for all the talk about keeping the streets clean, don't think for a minute that they're not into running their own ladies of the night. The Mackie family keeps their manor boundaries sparkling while they make sure the money comes from a clientele who can pay more for a bit of posh, instead of a quick one round the back of a garage with an underage girl run by a pimp.
You can't stop that? He shook his head.
Hardly worth trying. And that's not a job for us anyway. We'd pass it on to clubs and vice over in Soho. Mind you, they've got the Chinese gangs operating over there, so we have the odd parley about that lot. To be honest, it's the bane of our job, because most of the time we've all got our heads down sorting out what we can get done, rather than what we definitely can't, which means half the time the right hand hasn't a clue about the pudding the left hand's stirring.
Hmm, said Eleanor. Charlie, do you think there could be something bigger than usual on the cards concerning the Mackie family? Kettle stopped and turned to Eleanor. He took a deep draw on the remaining inch of his cigarette and dropped the end onto the pavement, grinding it with his foot as he blew smoke through his nostrils.
Miss White, there's something big, as you put it, going down with the Mackie family. You can bet on it, because there's always something big on the cards.
Though most of the time they're a canny lot. They plan it like they're going into battle. If they find holes and it's too risky, they chuck out the plan and think again. That's why they're successful. Though let's be fair, they have a higher tolerance for risk than the average man on the street, and that's why crime is their business.
Old Francisco trained his family well. He always told them to answer the why and the how of the job before they even started it, so there's not a second or a person unaccounted for. It's like school, you know. Do your homework and check it before handing it in. Now then, I know this much. There's the old geezer's way of doing things, and then there's his son's. Jim's dad is more or less at the top of the pile. But now, what with the old boy getting on, there's Jim Mackey's brothers and their cousins coming up, and they aren't as patient. They're starting to push against the old guard a bit because they want it all now, and John's generation are saying why not? The younger ones have got the money from their grandfather and fathers. Oh, and perhaps a bit from Elsie too, but they want to be top dogs, and they know any family power comes from the next big job, not all these smaller jobs. It could be their downfall, though, because keeping their manor safe and how it all looks to any rivals is as important as what a job brings in.
He sighed, squinting as he stared at the water.
So, yes, Miss White, of course I think something big is on the cards. Trouble is, where will the big happen and exactly how big is it? They've had a flawless innings for a good while, and it's well past time for them to dive in with something even more. Even more. Let's say even more ambitious. Charlie Kettle paused again, as if wondering whether he should go on. Eleanor did not interrupt, but allowed him to consider and then voice his thoughts. Kettle pressed his lips together, was silent for another second, then began again. You know, my eldest boy came home with his homework yesterday. Geography, it was. All about earthquakes. Not often I'm around to talk to him about it, but he loves all that stuff. Mountains and rivers, countries, studying maps. Anyway, he was telling me about it, and... you know, it was more interesting than I thought it would be, and it got me to thinking about all them earthquakes and how it's like London right now. You see, Miss White, my feeling is that there's an earthquake on the way, and what we have to do is find out where the rumbling's coming from and the... what did my lad call it? Yes, the epicentre. He stopped and looked out at the water. We have got to find the epicentre. The job at the top of the pyramid. Or the bottom, or the middle, depending upon how you look at it. I reckon my boy must have lost me after we got to the epicentre bit, because I can't remember where it is in relation to all the rumbling. Do you think Jim Mackey will falter? Will he get involved? Kettle shrugged. He's family, and family is hard to break up, especially that lot, where every cog has its place in a well-oiled wheel. But he's got that wife of his, and the little one, and now he's out on a limb. Cut himself off. The old boy won't have liked that, and neither will his father. There again, we have to assume that Jim and Rose Mackey could do with a tidy influx of cash. Working on a farm doesn't pay much, and neither does a tea shop. He shrugged. Jim Mackey might cave, or he might not. That's down to Rose, I would imagine, and how much pressure she can take. She's a good, respectable sort of girl, is Rose, but everyone has their limit. He turned to Eleanor, staring at her. I'm not one to speak without thinking. I watch. I listen. And out there, when I'm wearing down my shoe leather, I ask questions. And I know what you being in on this is all about, apart from the fact that you know the boss and you've brought in some information for him. But as I said, I watch and I listen, and I reckon you know that just because little Susan Mackey is a child, it doesn't mean she's safe. If the old boy or Johnny Mackey gave the word to do away with the three of them, it would happen just like that. He snapped his fingers. And it will be fast. Jim knows it, but I'm not sure Rose does. Eleanor nodded. Yes, I thought as much, Charlie. There's one more thing, and this is just what my nose tells me. He tapped his nose with his right forefinger. They want Jim back in the fold, with or without the girl. Him leaving the Mackey Manor is seen as a slight against everything Francisco has built up. DCI Warren told you what they were like, I'm sure. And what with Jim down there in the country now, working on a farm, well, him and Rose might as well have taken up residence in a sewer, as far as the family is concerned. Now, Jim being that far away, does it make a difference to the Mackey family's line of work in the grand scheme of things? He shook his head. Nah, not really. But it's like losing a tile off the roof. There's no big difference to the whole house, but if you know the tile's not there, it'll annoy you until that roof is mended. He lifted his hat. Nice talking to you, Miss White. I reckon you'd better be off to sort out that blackboard if DCI Warren is going to stand a chance of spotting any links between what they're all up to. Interesting, thought Eleanor, as she made her way across the street toward Trafalgar Square. Her conversation with Val about the blackboard had been in private, so it was clear she had to remember that even within Scotland Yard there were few secrets. She had been trained to act as if walls were thin everywhere, so she should have known better. Yet there were elements of greater importance to ponder. If she was not mistaken, Detective Sergeant Kettle had just made a comment revealing a level of doubt regarding his superior. Or was he joking about Warren standing a chance of spotting any links? Was Warren losing his touch, not accepting the evidence his men brought to him? Perhaps. It could have been a joke, but on the other hand, Eleanor was well aware that the British often served up
a hot and sizzling slight with a flourish of humour.
Despite rationing, despite the bleak aura left by 5 years of war, Hamleys was always a joyous place. The world's largest toy store had been bombed 5 times during the war, and every single time it carried on doing business, opening again even as the building was being made safe with staff wearing protective helmets as they brought joy to children waiting outside for a toy to be wrapped and handed to them. Navigating the store with the help of an assistant, Eleanor found a suitable blackboard. She purchased the largest one available and said yes, coloured chalks as well as plain white would be best. Thank you very much. She paid cash for the purchase, received a receipt, and asked for the blackboard to be delivered soonest to Detective Chief Inspector Warren at Scotland Yard. Indeed, she added, his boy would be delighted with the gift. As she made her way toward the door, a display of the new Rosebud dolls caught Eleanor's eye. She picked up one of the baby dolls, dressed in a little white bonnet with a ribbon tied under her chin and a matching broderie anglaise dress. Her lashes were long and her tiny vermilion lips were set in the sort of sweet, gentle pout Eleanor had only ever seen once on a living, breathing child. But real children weren't made of plastic, and that little girl had been wearing lipstick. She stared, mesmerized by the doll, but as she moved to return it to the place on display, a crying sound came from inside the body. It was a tinny wail of a cry that caused Eleanor to hold the doll to her chest. She looked around, embarrassed in case anyone had seen her, and once again reached forward to set the doll back on the display.
All the little girls love those. They're new. We've not long had them in, and they're going quite quickly, said an assistant now at Eleanor's side. She reached for the doll. She has sleeping eyes, see? They close when you lay her down, and of course she cries. Would you like that one, madam?
Eleanor looked down at the doll, at the innocent face in broderie anglaise dress. Yes. She smiled, imagining handing the doll to Susie Mackey and seeing her smile. Yes, I would like it. Could you put it in a box and wrap it for me? It's a present for a little girl.
Right you are, madam.
The assistant grinned.
And yes, for a little girl. After all, they're not usually for little boys.
Of course, silly me, said Eleanor, now following the woman toward the till. Another assistant stood nearby, her attention focused on a distressed woman.
I was waiting at the till, said the woman. You know, while you were answering all those questions from that young lady who wanted to know where the train sets were made because she didn't want any of those German trains for her little boy, and...
Yes, I remember, madam. I don't think she believed me even after I told her the train was made by Hornby. I assured her the company is British and the train sets are all manufactured here in England, but she still wasn't sure. I'm so sorry, it took such a long time to help her.
The woman shook her head, tears rolling down her cheeks.
I wouldn't have minded that, but when I came to the till, I know I had my purse and my handbag, and then, by the time that woman left, my handbag was open. And my purse was gone. I had £3 with me today, and now I have nothing. I can't even get home.
Are you sure you had the purse with you, madam? You could have come out without it. I know I've done the same thing.
Eleanor watched the woman become even more flushed.
Are you suggesting?
She took a deep breath as if to quell her frustration.
Look. I had my purse with me when I paid the bus conductor. It was in my handbag when I came into the shop because I checked, and I could still feel the weight of it just before I reached the till. What with all the people pushing and shoving past anyway, someone stole my purse in this shop.
She began to weep.
And now I don't know what to do.
Madam, said Eleanor, forgive me for interrupting, but I could not help overhearing this dreadful story. Would you be able to describe the woman to a policeman? If so, she looked at the shop assistant and smiled, if so, perhaps you could ask the manager to summon the police so the lady can make a statement? The assistant nodded.
I'll get the manager.
That's a start, said Eleanor, as the assistant walked away at a brisk clip. Now then, She lifted the flap of her shoulder bag and took out her purse, which she opened to remove 3 half-crowns. I think this should help out, madam.
That's very kind, but...
Eleanor smiled, shaking her head when the woman tried to return the money. Just do the same for another person if you ever see the opportunity. I am sure the manager and the police will listen with all seriousness, though I doubt they will find the thief. Can you remember what she looked like? The woman nodded.
If it was the woman behind me, well, she was very nicely turned out in a pale pink costume, you know, that sort of coral shade. Yes, coral, I think that's what they call it. She had blondish, reddish hair, black shoes, black handbag. She seemed very well to do, and as I said, she was behind me in the queue, and then she was gone.
She pulled a handkerchief from her pocket and wiped each eye in turn.
And I didn't feel a thing, nothing to make me turn around and look while she was lifting my purse. That's if it was her, and I'm sure it was.
If she was a professional shoplifter, you wouldn't have noticed her move, so don't blame yourself. Indeed, she might well have been working in concert with the woman in front of you, the one who was so distracting with her questions about the origin of toy trains. Just as she deflected attention at the Fenwick perfume counter, Eleanor wanted to add.
Your rosebud door, madam.
The assistant helping Eleanor handed her a wrapped parcel.
The little girl will absolutely love her. There are even sweet curls moulded at the back of her head. A door made like this will last a lot longer than the old china doors.
Eleanor opened the purse she was holding and took out the requisite amount to pay for the doll, then placed the purse in her shoulder bag and secured the clasp. With the parcel under her arm, she bid farewell to the woman who had been robbed of her money and thanked the assistant for her help in purchasing the doll. Leaving the shop, she knew that Elsie Finch was dealing in more than stolen clothing and perfume. She was a latter-day female Fagin, running her band of pickpockets, and they were attractive, well-turned-out thieves, the sort of women a good housewife would not try to avoid if she were standing close in the same queue, waiting to be served while shopping in one of the most well-known stores in London.